from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Later in this morning's program, we're going to talk about the recent rash of mass shootings in California in recent weeks, including last night's in Fresno, which claimed the lives of four people. But first, 50 years ago this week, 89 Native American men, women, and children seized the island of Alcatraz, launching a 19-month occupation and empowering a national Red Power movement for American Indian self-determination. We'll reflect on the life and legacy of one of the occupation's leaders, Richard Oakes, and talk to another leader, Lenata Warjack, about Native activism then and today. It's all coming up next, after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. Native students and activists stormed the island of Alcatraz by boat, launching a 19-month occupation in protest of federal denial of land and tribal rights. The occupation became a cornerstone of Native social justice activism in the 1960s and 70s and fueled a national Red Power movement for American Indian self-determination. This hour, we look back on the occupation of Alcatraz ahead of its 50th anniversary, and we'll talk about the state of Native American activism today. Later, I'll be joined by one of the main leaders of the occupation, Lenata Warjack. But first, we reflect on the life and legacy of Richard Oakes, another central leader of the occupation, with Kent Blancett. Kent Blancett is Associate Professor of History and Native American Studies at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and also author of the first biography of Richard Oakes, Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement. And welcome, Kent Blancett. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess the place to begin here is to talk about Richard Oakes and the Red Power Movement. It was really sort of dovetailing in some ways on the Black Power Movement that preceded it. It was a kind of what became known as Native Nationalism or Red Power. Before we talk about Richard Oakes and his role in this, which was central, let's talk about the movement itself.
Okay. That's a great way to start it off. And the origins, I think, of Red Power are pretty fascinating. And part of this goes back to a key word that you mentioned in your opening, which was Native nationalism. And that typically, even after the treaty signings and the reservation and or confinement periods following the Indian Wars, after the 1890s, we eventually enter into a period of Native nationalism in which Native nations are beginning to advocate strongly all the way from the end of the 19th century all the way to the beginning and through the middle of the 20th century for the protection and continuation of their treaty rights and the honoring of their independent sovereignty by the United States. They viewed themselves as allied nations. They would oftentimes Native peoples would go and volunteer for World War I, many of the times not having citizenship in the United States. That citizenship wasn't confirmed until after World War I for several of those veterans. But they fought primarily out of the notion that they were allied nations and view themselves as allied. So if the United States fell in World War I, we would have to thus renegotiate our treaties, and we'd face the possibility of losing all of our rights if the United States became another occupied territory. So out of this, it created a really strong sense of Native nationalism. And Red Power comes about in the scene really in the 1960s. And we see this starting and emerging with two primary organizations, one of those being the National Indian Youth Council, which is formed shortly after the Chicago Conference in the early part of the 1960s. And this is widely a Native student organization, but it would lend its voices towards one particular protest movement. And that protest movement was occurring on the West Coast in a place called Frank's Landing that was a part of the Nisqually Nation within Washington State. And the Nisqually had been working and fighting since even after World War II to protect their rights to the harvesting of salmon, which was a treated right to the Nisqually Nation. And this was joined by other nations like the Puyallup as well as the Muckleshoot throughout Washington State. out of this, they would join in what were called fish-ins. And the idea here being is that you would go out, you would fish out of season, you would be arrested by state game and fisheries officers. And part of this was is that acknowledgement that federal law is equal to that of tribal law, and that tribal law supersedes that of states, partly because we operate as treaty nations or allied nations with the United States. Therefore, state law couldn't apply to the fishing rights controversy. So after numerous arrests in which NIYC and these students would lend their bodies and their voices to that movement, it would really trigger this kind of call to direct action. And that call to direct action would also gain a new voice in the streets of San Francisco, which was a highly active Native community emerging out of the 1960s and 70s. It had a population of about 40,000 Native peoples. And of course, it was functioning out of two major policies that would increase the population or Native population of San Francisco. Those two policies were the Relocation Act of 1948, and then, of course, the termination legislation in 1953, known as House Concurrent Resolution 108. Each of these policies coupled together would bring Native peoples to the cities. Relocation would operate in a way in which one out of seven Native peoples would volunteer, and they would be sent under this BIA relocation program to one of six cities, and one of those cities was San Francisco. And part of this design by the BIA was to literally detribalize us as a people. The feeling is that we would go into the city and we would be a part of that great melting pot experiment of ethnic Americanization. We would cease to be Cherokee, Lakota, or Diné, and we would instead become Indian Americans or Native Americans, losing kind of our tribal identities and melting into the rest of society.
So, excuse me, a lot of this was really the force against just what you mentioned, that is the attempt to move toward assimilation and create an assimilation that would, in a sense, not only diminish but possibly even destroy American Indian identity.
That's exactly right. And coupled with that was the termination policy, and it gets its name from that kind of overt and covert design, which was to terminate the federal trust responsibility with Native nations directly so that we would be susceptible to private land development, we'd be susceptible to state jurisdiction, state taxation, and this was a way of crippling and removing our independence and our autonomy and our ability to control our own destinies within our own governments. And so out of this termination policy, there would be 109 Native nations between 1953 to 1970 that would be legislatively eradicated by the federal government. And out of this, we don't know the total numbers of Native peoples that would move from terminated nations into cities, but we know that there was definitely a correlation here because by 1970, over half of our populations in Indian country resided in American cities. So we were largely an urban population. But where the policies like relocation were meant to give people jobs, find them a place to live, give them some sort of allowance for groceries as well as to be able to kind of get the people's feet established within the city. Oftentimes when they arrived in the city, they would find these to be broken promises. And the institution that would spring up in the city, more importantly in San Francisco, that would help to try to curtail or dovetail that failed federal policy was the Indian Center itself, which was located in the Mission District of San Francisco and 16th and Valencia. And the Indian Center itself provided those services that the federal government failed to do. It provided a source or a place where you could find other Native peoples. You'd be able to sponsor at least cultural activities like powwows, social dances. You'd be able to find jobs or employment throughout the city. And of course, by 1970, San Francisco was a kind of budding community. There was about 450 Indian-owned businesses throughout the city. There was the American Indian Baptist Church, the Native American Church. There was other institutions beyond even the Indian Center, like Indian-owned bars, that served as a cornerstone to a very large Native population, but mostly centered in the Mission District of San Francisco.
So let me go with that to Richard Oakes, who came from Brooklyn. He was a Mohawk, and he was certainly a charismatic leader of what would become the Alcatraz occupation. He was also a youth who went through a great deal, trouble, really. I mean, trouble with the law at a fairly young age, but he got into American Indian identity in a very major way. And I wanted to have our listeners hear a quote fairly early on, Richard Oakes speaking to the press about the occupation.
What's this nation you want to establish out here?
An American Indian nation comprising of all the tribes, including the Alaskans.
Why Alcatraz?
Everybody can see it. On one end of the country, you have the Statue of Liberty, and this is just the opposite. You have a true reality of liberty.
Do you think you have the legal right to claim the island, and why?
Well, you're talking about two different societies now. In my society, or in the Indian society, yes, we do.
And that last quote from Richard Oakes simply reveals, I think, Ken Blanchett, to what extent the movement had to do and Alcatraz had to do with establishing Indian sovereignty and all of the tribes being brought together to move toward that Indian sovereignty. What I also wanted to kind of emphasize here and get your response to is the fact that he was a really charismatic leader and brought so many people together. And the idea, I think, that he put forward was that Alcatraz is not an island. It's an idea.
Yes. Alcatraz in and of itself was to serve as the symbol of red power, that for him, this idea was to say that what they're building on Alcatraz, which was free of government control, that was about self-determination, which was about creating an actually free community, free of colonization, free of government intervention, a society that was incredibly intertribal, that was designed by multiple nations, multiple languages, multiple cultural viewpoints and/or lifeways. It was to showcase what we could build and what was the potential of a future for Indian country, and that this idea of red power was also about nonviolent direct action. They didn't carry guns with them to the island. They carried their families. They carried their children with them to the island. And out of this, they were able to showcase and bring world attention through the media to the issues that we were facing, like relocation and termination. They were able to, at the same point in time, create Radio Free Alcatraz. They were able to create a newsletter. They were able to design native curriculum for the first time for a K-12 school that they created, which was the Big Rock School on the island. In other words, they were incredibly ingenious in what they were doing as far as using Alcatraz as a symbol to educate the rest of America about Indian oppression, but also this idea or greater idea of what our indigenous rights.
And Ken, if I may, since you mentioned no guns, it was a civil disobedience action. But later on, when Wounded Knee was occupied, it was very different and it came under different aegis.
That's a good point. And Wounded Knee would happen 3 years after Alcatraz. It would happen in 1973. And of course, out of this, we're starting to see a lot of success. If we were to go back to Alcatraz, that notion that Richard had of Alcatraz is not an island, it's an idea, is that the activism wasn't just curtailed to just the island. They began, especially after Richard Oakes left in January of 1970, after the death of his daughter, Yvonne Sherrod Oakes, they would move that activism to Seattle, and they would be successful in getting part of Fort Lawton turned over to the Indian community of Seattle, which today is the Daybreak Star Indian Center. That corresponded with $600,000 in Model Cities funds that were then given to the production of that Indian Center within the city of Seattle. They also began to lead occupations at Pitt River, LM, Clear Lake, as well as Rattlesnake Island. They were highly successful, especially in combating against the injustices of multinational corporations that had moved on to Pitt River lands in Northern California, corporations like PG&E Corporation, which were currently in the news. But they were successful in the sense of taking over those properties and getting arrested, and they still continued a nonviolence.
It also moves us forward to Standing Rock. I mean, there's a whole trajectory here. I wanted actually to go back to Alcatraz, though, for a moment, because Richard Oakes, let's hear him read part of the Alcatraz Proclamation and comment on their protest strategy back then.
In the name of all Indians, therefore, we reclaim this land for our Indian nations for all these reasons. We feel this claim is just and proper, and that this land should rightfully be granted to us for as long as the river shall run and the sun shall shine. Signed, Indians of All Tribes, November 1969, San Francisco, California. But in addition to that, we're also claiming the island outright on the grounds that this island does belong to us due to a prior claim that was thrown out in the white man's court. So we feel that we should do it the Indian way and claim it outright.
And he was really, and we're talking to Ken Blancett again, who is an associate professor of history and Native American studies at the University of Nebraska and author of Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz and the Red Power Movement. He was really, in some ways, saying not only are we sovereign and autonomous, but all these treaties have been broken.
That's correct. And they used, in the language to take over and claim the island, they used two elements that really spoke to federal Indian law. One of those was a previous treaty in which there was a previous takeover of Alcatraz in 1964 when the fish hens were happening in Washington State. It was led by a group of Lakota, and Belva Cottier had done a lot of the legal research, and they used the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 as the basis for that takeover of Alcatraz, because Alcatraz had been abandoned in 1963 by the federal government, and that treaty spoke to any abandoned property of the federal government could revert back over to the Lakota Nation and or peoples. So they use that as a precedence, and that's the precedence that Richard is mentioning in that prior precedence for the takeover of Alcatraz. They would also use another legal doctrine, which was the right of discovery, which was an issue going back even into the Marshall decisions of the early 19th century that was used to essentially claim title over Native lands throughout the United States. So they're basically reversing processes of colonization. They're challenging openly on the airways and through the media those systems of colonization that were used to strip us of our land and our titles as well as our sovereignty. And Alcatraz itself became a perfect symbol of that. It was a symbol that, as Richard mentioned earlier in the quotes that you played, it was to showcase this dual sense of justice in America, one sense of justice for non-natives, another sense of justice for native peoples. And in the process of this, this prison, this abandoned structure by the federal government was like the federal government had abandoned Indian rights in this country. It was also an island that didn't have any agriculture, didn't have any employment, didn't have any mineral resources. It lacked electricity. It lacked running water. It resembled, for many of the students that were involved in this occupation as Indians of all tribes, it represented the heart of Indian country. It represented most reservations at that time. And out of this, they were able to show how they were able to reinvent a community, how they were able to turn the power back on to Alcatraz, how they were able to restore the plumbing, how they were able to build a community, build schools, and start a radio station, and do this in a lasting period of over 19 months. Out of this, it would awaken Indian country. There would be hundreds of other occupations that would occur across this country, stretching to Wrigley Field in Chicago all the way to Ellis Island in New York City. Out of this, it would also spark a global indigenous movement in which other indigenous communities from Australia to New Zealand or Aotearoa to even Hawaii would use this as a chance to be able to do similar occupations or land reclamation. And that land reclamation in what Indians of all tribes started became the central tenet to the evolution or the definition of what is red power and how red power differs from that of black power. Because we were also employing our human rights, not just civil rights, but our human rights in regards to being treated nations.
Now, it was important, I think, that Malcolm X made that distinction between civil rights and human rights. And again, the Black Power movement really had a great deal of effect here. But you said Alcatraz was a symbol. In some ways, I think it's safe to say that, and I think you say it in your book, that Richard Oakes was emblematic of this whole Red Power movement.
Yes, and I think it's amazing because he grows up not in California. He grows up not in San Francisco. He's Akwesasne Mohawk, and he grows up in a very politically diverse community, Akwesasne being in northern New York. He grows up in a very a bustling community of Brooklyn as well as Akwesasne. And in Brooklyn, he was a part of ironworker gangs. And being a part of those ironworker forces, they built that famed skyline of New York City that we know so well in Manhattan.
They worked on the skyscrapers and the bridges, really, and many of them were Mohawks, members of his tribe, right?
Exactly. And Richard wore the scars of that industry very proudly. But it also taught him a lot about leadership. It taught him a lot about teamwork. It taught him a lot about how to construct something bigger than life, bigger than oneself. And also, I think working 80 stories up above means that you kind of tackle your fears. And I think he was the right person for the right time to be speaking to the press, because it seemed to be that he didn't have that kind of fear, right? He had other things in life that scared him, but speaking to the press was not one of them. And he also had this just uncanny ability to put his finger on the pulse of what was happening in Indian country. His trip across America from New York to San Francisco was like this Gandhi-esque trip where he was stopping off at other reservations and Indian communities, and he was asking them about their own histories. And it's important to understand that, you know, classes like Native Studies or Indigenous Studies did not exist until Richard arrived in San Francisco, until Lineta Means arrived at Berkeley, and they were caught in some of the biggest college campus strikes in our nation's history, which it's also the 50th anniversary of, in which San Francisco State College and Berkeley formed ethnic studies for the first time. And also, this
and we should say that Richard graduated from San Francisco State. He came to the mission in 1968?
Yes. And then he became the first coordinator of Native American Studies at San Francisco State. And then, of course, out of that, he's an alum of San Francisco State College, is what it was called back then. And for Richard, it was this really interesting kind of fusion of the Third World Liberation Front, the Brown Berets, the Black Panther Party being in Oakland. What they began to do is they began to create also coalition politics. And that's really kind of at the heart not only of Red Power, but it's at the heart of 1960s organizing that a lot of historians have missed, in the sense of looking at this as an interethnic kind of politic or coalition that's developed in order to be able to support greater human rights and or civil rights through these organizations. And we could see this with the Brown Berets in 1972 taking over Catalina Island. We could see it within the Black Panther Party, certain members renaming themselves Geronimo Pratt, for instance, but also offering to work security for Alcatraz Island. To go back to your earlier point,
Want to make one other point. When they occupied Alcatraz, they actually put up a picture of Geronimo.
Yes, Geronimo became a central idea for leadership. Many historians over the years had labeled him the last kind of the free Indians, at least in his campaign to avoid capture and emplacement on a reservation as a Chiricahua Apache. And out of that, he became a symbol of resistance. He became a symbol not just of resistance, but Native nationalism. And out of this, what does it mean, you know, in a sense to be truly free?
Yeah, Ken, forgive me. We got seconds left. I want to go back to the point you were going to make before, though. You were about to make a point.
Yeah, the point I wanted to make is, you know, you mentioned the violence that would swell over this movement, and it was swelling over this entire country at the time. I mean, a violence that we'd seen in Vietnam, a violence that we saw playing out, at least in terms of revolution within the city streets or urban unrest and rioting. It was a violence that was in the form of assassinations, and it was a violence that would meet occupiers at Wounded Knee in 1973.
Well, there's a lot in
just to defend themselves at that point.
We could use another hour, but I'm really glad I had you on here, and I thank you for being with us. And again, Ken Blanchett is Associate Professor of History and Native American Studies. His book is The Journey of Freedom, Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz and the Red Power Movement. He'll be at the Outdoor Art Club in Mill Valley on Thursday, November 21st at 6:30 p.m., and we thank him again for being with us on Forum. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. I'm joined now by one of the main leaders of the opposition, the occupation of Alcatraz, Lineta Warjack, and she's a member of the Shoshone and Bannock tribes. She's also the first Native American student to enroll at UC Berkeley, and she's the author of a new book called Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Light. We spoke in the first part with Kent Blanchett, and we talked a lot about rights and about Native rights particularly and the reasons for going to Alcatraz, part of the Red Power movement, the denial of rights and certainly tribal rights by unfortunately our own government for so long and treaties. First of all, Lineta, glad to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good to be here.
I guess the place I'd like to begin with you is just talking about, the actual occupation itself. Initially, there was a kind of, roaming around, scouting things. And then Richard Oakes, for example, dove in. And ultimately, You had 20 tribal groups going from out of Sausalito when the occupation actually began?
Well, no, we organized as a student group from UC Berkeley, San Francisco State. And with UC Berkeley, when we had the Third World Strike at Berkeley, then we were able to get Native American studies throughout the state of California, through every University of California campus. So we didn't have cell phones at that time, but we did have telephones, and we just called our Native American studies departments, and they all arrived.
There were a couple of pleasure boats, though, that went out initially with children aboard?
Well, we initially went out, the 14 of us from San Francisco State and UC Berkeley. I was a chair of the student group from UC Berkeley, and Richard was a chair of the student group from San Francisco State. And we went out and took the island that night. But prior to that, Adam Nordwall had a publicity stunt to go around the island.
And that was what I was alluding to.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So we did go out around the island and checked it out, and Richard jumped off and a few other students trying to swim to the island, but those guys, they were not in shape to swim to the island. So fortunately, the Coast Guard picked him up, and so when we got back to the mainland, we went to the Indian Center and decided, hey, we're going to go take the island, you know.
We're going to do the real thing. As
right.
As so, I said to Richard, you know, we went in and started actually chanting and dancing and putting up a picture of Geronimo.
No.
No?
No, I don't know. There's a lot of stories.
This is according to Ken Blansett, whom we spoke to earlier.
I know, but he wasn't there. I was.
Well, you're setting the record straight here, which is really what we need to do. We got a good history lesson from him. We'll get one from you, obviously, as well. Talk about your motivation, though. I mean, in this, and it's important to know that there were women involved in this. I know I read an interview you did where you said patriarchy was pretty much the rule of, not necessarily the rule of law, but the rule of what was going on. But there was this great matriarchal heritage that Native American women had that was tied to the earth and tied to your sensibilities, really.
Well, the matriarchal heritage is the balance of both male and female. So that's why I and Richard worked together. But the patriarchy of the media at that time was only centered towards the male.
But you were there, and actually Jim Thorpe's daughter, Grace Thorpe, was there. There were a number of women there.
Right. Well, I actually got the boat to the island that took us out there the first time with the students. And we had to turn around and go back and pick up Richard because he got stuck in traffic, and we needed to be doing something while we were waiting for him. So the fishermen were coming in and with their catch, and I was able to get them to take us out to the island, and Richard never did show up, so we started out, and then I looked back towards the docks, and it was dark, and I could see silhouettes of them running on the docks, so I had them turn around and go back and pick them up.
Talking about Alcatraz and the occupation, it's ironic in many ways. The occupation has a very different meaning these days politically and other ways. Just like nationalism, this was the Native nationalism movement. That has different meanings that we've talked about. We're talking to Lenaida Warjack. She's a former leader of the occupation, a member of the Shoshone and Bannock tribes, and author of a new book called Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. And this was intergenerational.
Yes, it was. It stems from the genocide to the boarding schools to the reservation life and then to the relocation program and what happened from that point on, because I was on the actual relocation program sent here to San Francisco when I was 18.
And I just want to get the trajectory right, because as we said, there was first kind of a scouting and then the actual ships that went out and occupied. But there was a number of Sioux Indians who occupied the island earlier in opposition to the 1868 treaty that we spoke of earlier. Yeah.
Right. It was a Lakota landing party that came out in 1964, right after the prison had been vacated. And they made claim to the island based upon the 1868 treaty, and it was also federal Indian law. So when the city of San Francisco was going to turn the island over to a developer by the name of
Lamar Hunt, the oil man, yeah.
Right. Then, you know, to us it was a slap in the face that they were not going to recognize another treaty, and already we were already sensitive to the 500-plus treaties that had already been broken, so it was another treaty been broken right in front of our face. And so we, that was enough to spark us to move, to just go ahead and take the island.
It's also an irony in this, in some sense, that Richard Nixon turned out to be of some help in terms of working back toward the treaties and making things right by the Native Americans. I say ironic because we're going through another impeachment hearing now, and certainly the analogies to Watergate are pretty much with us. But I was also struck by the fact that Nixon, and many people have said, that did a lot for the environmental movement. He did, you know, considerable amount more than others previously for the Native American movement.
Yes, Richard Nixon was the first and only, I might add, president that has ever done anything for Native American people. And with that, we send him our prayers and our blessings, because he did stop the termination era that was in progress that took the whole state of California away from Native American tribes. In Washington, Oregon, Minnesota, 106 tribes were terminated at that time, and the rest of us were on the chopping block.
Talking about Native activists actually taking over and occupying Alcatraz, it's 50 years later, and the anniversary is being brought to the attention of the public, and we're doing exactly that. We do want to hear from you. You have memories of the occupation of Alcatraz, and really, what significance does the protest and its legacy hold for you? You can give us a call now, and we want to hear your thoughts. Toll-free number to join us, 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. And you can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email any questions or comments you might have, or memories you might have, to forum@kqed.org. And let's go to a cut of actually you speaking, Lenita.
Oh, we can stay up here as long as, I mean, you know, we can. It's indefinite how long we can stay here, because we're not subject to any different type of conditions that we aren't subjected to out there in the city or on the reservation. You know, like, it's always cold, and you know, you never have that much to eat anyway. So
this is not as comfortable as the average Indian reservation. Is that what you're saying?
It's average for an Indian way of life anyway. Now, I mean, today, it's nothing different.
That's Lenita Warjack on tape, and that was she's here with us in studio. That was Lenita in November 1969 in response to a KQED news reporter who asked her how long they think it's possible to continue the occupation. And when you look back, what are you thinking when you hear a cut like that?
It's pretty amazing to hear yourself 50 years ago, but that was true, and I'm glad that I was able to capture the time, the moment. Of course, it was a lot better within our traditional setting of how we lived. It was a lot better then, but out on the reservations and in the urban ghettos, it was pretty miserable. And of course, when you're young and coming out to the island, it's you never get really that cold, or you have no fear. You're just ready to do it.
Your adrenaline is working overtime, and you're
right.
Exhilarated, right?
Yes.
You have all that passion of youth. Here's another Native American occupier talking about the vision for what Alcatraz could be.
Well, we want a university here. We want an ecology center. We want an Indian museum. We want a Native American studies department. We want to do something here for our own people. The white man's tried to educate us for the last 400 years, and it's been a dismal failure. So we should be allowed the opportunity to try to see what we can do for our own people.
There's that ambition again, right? That resonates,
well,
yeah.
Yes, that was Stella Leach. She was really an incredible woman. She was a nurse on the island, brought Dr. Tepper, and they operated the first aid place for us if anyone got hurt. She was much older. She was in her 50s, and she was pretty matriarchal. She supported us. She was really an incredible woman.
Well, let me bring a caller. And by the way, we do want to hear your memories and your thoughts as we come up upon the half-century anniversary of the Alcatraz occupation. Toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. And here's Nomi. Nomi, join us. Hi.
Hi, I'm driving. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Just be careful while you're driving.
Great. Yes, thank you. Blessings. I thank the speaker and all of your ancestors, and I'm grateful that you're here talking about the occupation. I go every year in support. And my question, why do you continue to have ceremony at Alcatraz this time of year? What is the ultimate goal? Is there not an ultimate goal? Like, I understand the purpose, but I just wonder what the larger vision was or is. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for that question. Lenita, can we go to you on that?
Okay. We do our prayers every single day. So ceremonies are extra special for the region and for Sunrise on Alcatraz that we do about this time of the year is international, because when you greet the sun that early in the morning, sound comes from your heart and your soul out through your mouth. So you're praying, and sound travels on light, goes directly to the sun, comes back as the world turns, and it turns everything positive. So you're praying for the plants and the animals, the people, the universe. You're praying for everything that happens and impacts worldwide, and that's why that's so important.
It's also important to recognize that so much of what's been characterized as a Red Power movement had to do with these kind of spiritual tenets and beliefs.
Well, Red Power to us just meant a spiritual movement.
And yet going to Alcatraz had a whole spiritual underpinning to it, did it not?
Yes, it initiated the re-identification of our people, and to re-identify and reconnect with our culture and our heritage, because the United States Congress passed law to make it illegal for us to speak our languages, our culture, practice our culture, our prayers, and our ceremonies. So this was reconnecting and reestablishing it again.
It's a kind of cultural genocide. It's often been characterized that way. I mean, for the purpose of assimilation, supposedly.
Right, and being out on relocation was to assimilate us, the next generation, into the mainstream of American society so as to do away with the so-called Indian problem. But it was a completely nonviolent and spiritual kind of a movement.
Well, as I said with Ken Blanchard, it got violent at Wounded Knee a few years later in 1972.
Well, that was the American Indian Movement.
You separated yourself from the American Indian Movement.
Yeah. Because I told those guys to learn from our experience on Alcatraz, because it was a nonviolent movement. Native American movement is a spiritual movement. It's not attached to violence. And they wouldn't listen to me. They didn't respect the 19-month occupation or me as a woman, because they were coming from the patriarchy. Like I said, people were just re-identifying as Native people, so they didn't really know what it was, and they wouldn't listen to my advice.
This changed, though, now with Spirit Rock and all?
It did. And those guys, even the American Indian Movement, finally became very spiritual, but it took that long, and we were already there.
You had to teach them.
We were trying to tell them.
I asked for memories. Here's Enrique, who writes, I was on the island in 1969 and 1970. I went to see if we could restore the electricity by turning the steam plant back on. I also did my high school film project on the island and was friends with John Trudell, who made it possible for me to get on the island. I was 16 years old. And here's Kathleen from San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen.
Good morning. I have a sort of a personal favor to ask. If your guest has any recollections of Dr. Dick Fine, a physician who I believe was my late husband, and he told me stories of conducting a weekly clinic where he treated people who were ill or injured. I think a lot of people were sick because of conditions on the island. And does your guest have any recollections of Dr. Fine?
No, I don't. The only ones I know were Stella Leach and Dr. Tepper, because they were part of us in our community.
What about what the caller says, though, about the illnesses and infirmities and stuff that affected people who occupied the island?
Well, there wasn't really a lot of illnesses because we were young and healthy and we didn't have a lot of issues.
Kathleen, I thank you for the call. Go to another caller. Meg, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. My family's non-native, but I was only six at the time, and the Alcatraz movement brought the subject up in my family, and I can remember distinctly my grandfather, who'd been a longtime resident of Eureka, talking about knowing of men who would go out and shoot at Native American women and children. And so I just want people to understand how important this was as far as raising the understanding in families all over the Bay Area about what racism really meant, how deep it went.
Well, I thank you for that call, and it's, I think, important for people to realize just how much racism there was. I remember seeing signs about wanting to kill Indians and all of that sort of thing. We don't necessarily have the awareness of just how bad it was for Native people.
Yeah, the genocide was pretty bad, and then after we went into the boarding school era where the children were taken from their parents and put into Christian and government boarding schools. And I came up in the time where it was no Indians or dogs allowed, and we could only sit on in a separate place in the movie theater or drink out of certain public facilities.
It was an apartheid system, basically.
Yes.
It was Jim Crow type of system.
It was. It was pretty bad. And on the reservations, it was pretty bad. You couldn't get a job in town, or racism and discrimination was pretty high, although in 1964, when they passed the Civil Rights Act, they took down the signs, but the feelings were still there.
Especially in certain places where there was a big tribal presence, unfortunately. I'm sure you're familiar with, I mentioned the other day, just ironically on the air, the writer Leslie Marmon Silko, who has made this vivid and palpable in terms of, because you mentioned taking children away. I mean, she writes about that kind of phenomenon, to have them learn English. And because in many cases there was tuberculosis and there were other problems that we use as an excuse to take the children. Let me bring some more callers aboard here. And we go next to you, Antonio. You're on the air.
Okay. Hi, Lineda. My name is Antonio. I wanted to ask you for what you want to share with the younger generation, the next generation. What would you advise us to continue or to start to do, and in what way? Of course, we based in our values with our ancestors and honoring them in every way possible, spiritually and et cetera. What would you advise us to continue to do in today's uncertain future in this country that is poised to still try to terminate our culture and our very existences?
Antonio, I got to give you props. It's nice to hear a young person asking for some wisdom from someone who was there 50 years ago. What would you tell youth, Native American youth?
I would say be as knowledgeable as you can. Learn as much as of your history and your background. Be ready to speak. Get the best education possible. And balance that with your Native culture and your ceremonies, your prayers. Be able to go forth in the future by balancing both worlds, and be ready to speak up and do what you can, because that's the only reason why I ever did what I did, was because if there wasn't anyone around to do it or to speak up, then I would do it. You just have to be ready.
And where do you see, let me thank Antonio for the call, where would you like to see the Native movement going now? I mean, in terms of occupations or getting back rights, or where are they headed and ought they to be headed?
Well, it's a different day and time.
Yes, of
and
course.
The the powers that be, so to speak, are very hurtful and harmful and destructive. So I believe it's really important to maintain your prayers and your strategy, because that's what got us through the genocide and everything that happened to us. And people don't realize the importance of that, but that's how we keep going.
But the fights are still being fought. Like I mentioned, Spirit Rock. I mean, those
kind
of fights.
Well, you just have to maintain the nonviolence. Because if once you pick up a gun or become violent, then you're a target and they'll kill you.
Let me bring another caller aboard here, and that's Susan. Susan, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Excuse me. I keep saying Spirit Rock, and I mean Standing Rock. Spirit Rock is a place where you go to meditation and Buddhist teachings. Standing Rock is what I've been alluding to or meaning to allude to. Susan, I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
That's okay. Thank you so much for this program this morning. It's very, very moving. When we were 15, it was the 60s, so we went to a free school in Sausalito, and we learned how to maintain a boat. And so we brought food around to the back to the docks. And for many of us, it was really our first experience of political and social realities. And I just wanted to thank the guests very, very much for everything that they have done. Because particularly fast forward, one of the things we did is we became medicine makers. And we were able to make medicine and give them to John Trudell up in Northern California for his transition. And my final question is, as nomenclature changes, what's the right word? What, you know, do people like Native American, American Indian, Indian? What does the guest feel is the right way to respectfully address people who are Native American? Thanks.
Well, I've pretty much used Native Indigenous people because, you know, I respect India people from India, Indian people, and, you know, they're different than who we are, and I don't want to confuse anyone. So we just kind of have to take on our own term for who we are as Indigenous Native people from here, from this continent.
People do get confused, though, don't they?
They do, and, yeah, our people do as well because the government has federal Indian law and everything's still called Indian from the government. And even like my tribe that is Bannock, but it's really Banukwet, and they've never been able to acknowledge my name as a Native person either.
Your other tribe is Shoshone, and a lot of people say Shoshone, but that's the language, actually, Shoshone, yeah.
Yes, the Shoshone Nation extended from Canada to Mexico, and it composed many different tribes and groups, the Paiute, the Ute, Shoshone, Shoshone, the Bannock, the Comanche, the Hopi. I mean, it's a large linguistic-related group.
Speaking about linguistic related, I have to ask you because the use of the word genocide has been debated over and over. I mentioned cultural genocide, but you know there are those who say, well, certainly Indians were sinned against. There was terrible racism. They were killed indiscriminately and killed just because they were seen as the enemy. But you hear some historians and read some historians who say more Indians were killed because of disease and because of plague than necessarily at the hands of, well, the white man. What are your thoughts on that?
It was both, but probably more the genocide because it was intentional. And the disease was a way to, was used as a weapon as well to give them the smallpox infested blankets to kill them off. Because our people didn't have those diseases. We were clean people.
You gave blankets with smallpox in them. I mean, literally.
Yes.
And I know you're getting a very important emergency phone call, and I don't want to keep you here against your will or because you're so courteous in being here. We've actually got about 3 minutes left. Can you spend the last 3 minutes?
I have another radio show.
Oh, is that what's happening?
Yeah.
Somebody is one-upping us. Well, let me give you a quick just a thank you, and then we'll take more calls if we can have the time to do that. This is from Diana, who says, I want to thank your guest and all those organizing Indigenous People Day on the island. I'm bringing my kids to the sunrise at Alcatraz. My daughter has decided to do a major school project on Shoshone tribes now. Thank you for allowing my kids the opportunity to learn and grow. We have ancestry roots to the Zuni tribe, but have lost traditions to celebrate this part of our own history. You have changed this. Thank you. And that is,
thank you.
We'll say goodbye to our guest because she has to go do another radio interview. But we'll take more of your calls because I know many of you want to express your thoughts and feelings and memories. Let's go to Barbara. Barbara, you're on the air.
Yes, yes. I am not Native American, but I have visceral reaction to some of the things I witnessed. I was a student at San Francisco State College during the strike with the tax squad there, the terrifying environment, and I remember it vividly. I've also visited the Pocatello Reservation of Shoshone Bannock and seen the poverty there. It's really terrible how we've treated our Native American citizens. I've also been in Brigham City, Utah, where there are children's barracks, where those children were separated from their parents. So I thoroughly empathize with the movement. So thank you for hearing me.
I'm glad you were heard, and I thank you for that call and appreciate hearing from you. And I think it's really the lesson from all this, especially as we come upon the 50-year anniversary, is the importance of reading history and reading history told as mercilessly as often it can be told. But there are some great Native American writers. I mentioned Leslie Marmon Silko. I want to mention a few more. Louise Erdrich, if any of you are familiar with her work or not, you should read her. And I'll put in a word for Sherman Alexie, too. Thank you so much for being a part of this morning's forum program. In our opening hour, we have another hour ahead, and let me tell you what's up ahead. We're going to spend some time with Ron Elving talking about impeachment and more, and we're also going to check in about this recent killing in Fresno and really talk about with a sociologist who's really outlined and done some serious data analysis about mass killings and mass shootings. It's all in the hour ahead. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.